I'm Virginia Prescott. Today, NHPR and the Music Hall present Writers on a New England Stage with Jodi Pico, recorded live at the Music Hall in Portsmouth, a co-production of NHPR and the Music Hall. Pico is a phenomenally successful novelist with more than 14 million books in print worldwide. Small Great Things is her most recent. Like previous books, it debuted at number one on bestsellers lists. Pico devotees will recognize the relatable, everyday characters thrashing through controversial ethical issues, seemingly ripped from the headlines. But for her, Small Great Things was different. It's about racism, white privilege, and the inherited inequities of America's past and present. She says it was one of the hardest books to write. The Washington Post called it her most important. In an author's note, Pico mentioned a story that made her want to write about racism just a few years into her career as a novelist. We sat down together on stage at the Music Hall in Portsmouth, and I asked her about that story and why she finally decided to tackle racism in 2016.
So I, about 25 years ago, was living in New York, and there was a real-life news story about an African-American undercover cop who had been shot four times in the back by his white colleagues on the subway, even though he was wearing something called the color of the day, which was this wristband that identified him as an undercover cop. And I started to write this book because it was really upsetting to me. And I failed miserably. I just couldn't seem to create authentic voices, authentic characters, an authentic story. And I really wrestled with whether I had the right to write a book. I'm a white woman. Why should I be writing about racism? Not my story to tell. And, you know, for years, I would play devil's advocate with myself. I'd say, well, you know, you write all the time in the voices of people you're not. You write as men. You write as Holocaust survivors. You write as school shooters. You write as rape victims. You've never been any of those things. And then I would ask, why is this different? Well, it's because race is different. Racism is different. We can't talk about it without being afraid of offending people. And so very often we make the choice not to talk about it at all. So fast forward to 2012, and I come across yet another news story that really captivates me. It's the story of an African-American nurse in Flint, Michigan, who had 20 years of experience on a labor and delivery ward, and who helped deliver a baby. The father called in her supervisor and said, I don't want her or anyone who looks like her to touch my kid, pushed up his sleeve to reveal a swastika tattoo. And in their infinite wisdom, the hospital put a post-it note on the baby's file saying, no African-American personnel to touch this baby. She wound up suing. She settled out of court. I hope she got lots and lots of money. But it made me kind of wonder, what if? What if I could turn this into a novel? What if that nurse was the only one alone with a kid when something went wrong, and she had to decide between following her supervisor's orders or saving a baby's life? What if, as a result of that, she wound up on trial, defended by a white public defender who, like me, like a lot of my friends, would never consider themselves to be a racist? What if I could tell the story in the alternating points of view of the nurse, the public defender, and the white supremacist father, as they all began to unpack their beliefs about race and power and privilege? And suddenly, it was like this light went off. I knew I was going to be able to finish this book. And it was because I had shifted my intent and I had shifted my audience. I was not writing a book to tell people of color how hard their lives are. That is not my story to tell, and it never will be. And frankly, there are plenty of amazing authors of color doing an excellent job of that without me. I was writing to tell the people who look like me that even though it's easy to point to a skinhead and say, that's a racist, it's a lot harder to point to yourself and say the same thing.
Here's Jodi Pico reading in the voice of one of those characters, a labor and delivery nurse she calls Ruth Jefferson.
The most beautiful baby I ever saw was born without a face. From the neck down, he was perfect. 10 fingers, 10 toes, chubby belly. But where his ears should have been, there was a twist of lips and a single tooth. Instead of a face, there was a swirling eddy of skin. His mother, my patient, had received prenatal care, including an ultrasound, but the baby had been positioned in a way that the facial deformity hadn't been visible. No one was expecting this. Maybe for that very reason, she chose to deliver at our little cottage hospital and not Yale New Haven, which is better equipped for emergencies. She labored for 16 hours before she delivered. The doctor lifted the baby, and there was nothing but silence. Is he all right? The mother asked, panicking. Why isn't he crying? The OB silently met my gaze and turned back to the parents. In soft words, he said their child had profound birth defects that were incompatible with life. On a birth pavilion, death is a more common patient than you'd think. When we have anencephalies or fetal deaths, we know the parents still have to bond with and mourn for that baby. So I cleaned him and swaddled him the way I would any other newborn, while the conversation behind me stopped and started like a car choking through the winter, questions no one ever wants to ask and no one ever wants to answer. The mother was still crying when I settled the baby in the crook of her elbow, his tiny hands windmilled. She wore an expression I've only seen in paintings in museums of a love and a grief so fierce that they forged together to create some new, raw emotion. I turned to the father. Would you like to hold your son? He looked like he was about to be sick. I can't. He bolted from the room. I cornered him in the parents' lounge. Your wife and your son need you. That's not my son. That thing is not going to be on this earth for very long, which means you better give him all the love you had stored up for his lifetime right now. When we entered the hospital room, his wife was still nuzzling the infant. I took the tiny bundle from her arms and handed the baby to her husband. I thought about my actions, you know, if I did the right thing, if it was my place. When the father started to cry, the sob shook his body like a hurricane bends a tree. He sank down beside his wife on the hospital bed. They took turns holding their son for 10 hours. That mother, she even tried to let him nurse. I couldn't stop staring, because it was the most remarkable thing I'd ever seen. Love has nothing to do with what you're looking at, and everything to do with who's looking. When the infant died, it was peaceful. We made casts of the newborn's hand and foot for the parents to keep. I heard the same couple came back 2 years later and delivered a healthy daughter. It just goes to show you, every baby is born beautiful. It's what we project on them that makes them ugly. On Thursdays, my shift goes from 7 a.m. till 7 p.m. We usually have two nurses on the birthing pavilion, three if we're swimming in human resources. I note how many delivery suites are occupied, three right now, a nice slow start to the day. Marie, the charge nurse, is already in the room where we have our morning meeting when I come inside, but Corinne, the second nurse on shift, is missing. What's it going to be today? Marie asks. Flat tire, I reply. This guessing game is a routine. What excuse will Corinne use today for being late? Ah, that was last week. I'm going with the flu. She looks up from the regional section of the paper. I saw Edison's name in here again. My son has made the highest honors list for every semester of his high school career, but just like I tell him, that's no reason to boast. There are a lot of bright kids in this town. Still, Marie says, for a boy like Edison to be so successful, well, a boy like Edison. I know what she's saying, even if she's careful not to spell it out. There are not many black kids in the high school, and as far as I know, Edison's the only one on the highest honors list. Comments like this feel like paper cuts, but I've worked with Marie for over 10 years now, so I try to ignore the sting. White people don't mean half the offensive things that come out of their mouths.
You're listening to Jodi Picou reading from her novel, Small Great Things for Writers on a New England Stage, a special edition of Word of Mouth.
Corinne explodes into the room. Sorry I'm late. That stupid tire I replaced last week, it has a leak or something. Marie reaches into her pocket and pulls out a dollar, which she flicks across the table at me. All right, Marie says. Floor report. Room 2 is Jessica Myers. She had a vaginal delivery this morning at 3 a.m. I'll take her, Corinne and I say in unison. Everyone wants the patient who's delivered. It's the easier job. I had her during active labor, I point out. Right, Marie says. Ruth, she's yours. Room 3, Thea McVaughn, she's in active labor. I've got her, Corinne says. We only take one active labor patient at a time if we can help it, which means that the third patient will be mine. Room 5 is a recovery. Brittany Bauer was a gestational diabetic, baby's on quarterly blood sugars. Got it. I push away from the table to go find Lucille, the night nurse, who hands me Brittany Bauer's file. Davis, I read. That's the baby? Yeah, I haven't done the bath or the newborn assessment yet. No problem. Is that it? The dad's name is Turk, Lucille says. Something, I don't know, a little off about him. Like Creeper Dad? Last year, we had a father who was flirting with the nursing student in the room during his wife's delivery. When she wound up having a C-section, instead of standing behind the drape near his wife's head, he strolled across the OR and said to the nursing student, "Is it hot in here, or is it just you?" "No, no, he's just sketchy. I don't know, I can't put my finger on it." I knock softly. "I'm Ruth. I'm going to be your nurse today." I smile down at the baby cradled in Brittany's arms. "Oh, isn't he a sweetie? What's his name?" I ask, although I already know. It's a means to start a conversation. Brittany doesn't answer. She looks at her husband, a hulking guy who's sitting on the edge of his chair. He's got military short hair, and he's bouncing the heel of one boot. I get what Lucille saw in him. Turk Bauer makes me think of a power line that snapped during a storm and lies across the road just waiting for something to brush against it so it can shoot sparks. Doesn't matter if you're shy or modest. Nobody who's just had a baby stays quiet for long. They want to share this life-changing moment. But Brittany, well, it's almost like she needs permission to speak. Domestic abuse, I wonder? "Davis," she chokes out. "His name is Davis." "Well, hello, Davis. Would you mind if I take a listen to his heart and lungs?" Her arms clamp tighter on the newborn. "I could do it right here. You don't have to let go of him." You have to cut a new parent a little bit of slack, especially one who's already been told her baby's blood sugar's a bit low. So I tuck the thermometer under Davis's armpit and get a normal reading. I look at the whorls of his hair. A patch of white can signify hearing loss. An alternating hair pattern can flag metabolic issues. I press my stethoscope against the baby's back, listening to his lungs. I slide my hand between him and his mother, listening to his heart. Whoosh! It's so faint, I think it's a mistake. I listen again, trying to make sure it wasn't a fluke. Turk stands up, so he's towering over me. Nerves look different on fathers. They get combative sometimes, as if they could bluster away whatever's wrong. I hear a very slight murmur, I say delicately, but it could be nothing. Still, I'll have the pediatrician take a listen. While I'm talking, trying to be as calm as possible, I do another blood sugar. It's an AccuCheck, which means we get instant results. "Now, this is great news," I say, trying to give the Bowers something positive to hold on to. "Davis's sugar is much better." I walk to the sink and fill water in a plastic bowl and set it on the warmer. "Why don't I get him cleaned up and we can try nursing again?" I scoop the baby up, place Davis on the warmer, and begin my exam. I can hear Brittany and Turk whispering fiercely as I check the fontanelles on the baby's head for suture lines to make sure the bones aren't overriding each other. The parents are worried, and that's normal. A lot of patients don't like to take the nurse's opinion on any medical issue. They need to hear it from the doctor, even though nurses are often the ones who first notice a quirk or a symptom. I look for facial bruising, hematoma, abnormal shaping of the skull. I check the palmar creases in his tiny hands. I measure the circumference of his head and the length of his squirming body. I scan the base of the spine for dimples or hair tufts or any other indicator of neural tube defect. The whispering behind me has stopped. But instead of feeling more comfortable, it feels ominous. What do they think I'm doing wrong? By the time I flip him back over, Davis's eyes are starting to drift shut. Babies usually get sleepy a couple hours after delivery, which is one reason to do the bath now. It'll wake him up long enough to try to feed again. I diaper him, wrap him up in a blanket like a burrito. The last thing I do is put an ID band on him that will match the ones his parents have and fasten a tiny electronic security bracelet on his ankle. I can feel the parents' eyes hot on my back. "There," I say, handing the infant to Brittany again. "Clean as a whistle. Now let's see if we can get him to nurse." I reach down to help position the baby, but Brittany flinches. "Get away from her," Turk Bauer says. "I want to talk to your boss." They are the first words he has spoken to me in the 20 minutes I've been in this room. I'm pretty sure he doesn't want to tell Marie what a stellar job I've done. I find her filling out a chart. "We've got a problem in 5, I say. "Father wants to see you." "What happened?" "Absolutely nothing," I reply. I told them I heard what sounded like a murmur and that I'd contact the pediatrician and I bathed the baby and did his exam. I must be doing a pretty awful job of hiding my feelings, though, because Marie looks at me sympathetically. Maybe they're worried about the baby's heart. I'm just a step behind her as we walk in. "I understand you wanted to see me, Mr. Bauer?" Marie asks. "That nurse," Turk says. "I don't want her touching my son again." Heat spreads from the collar of my scrubs. No one likes to be called out in front of her supervisor. "I can assure you that Ruth is one of the best nurses we have, Mr. Bauer. If there's a formal complaint, I don't want her or anyone who looks like her touching my son, the father interrupts, and he folds his arms across his chest. He's pushed up his sleeves while I was out of the room. Running from wrist to elbow is the tattoo of a Confederate flag. Marie stops talking. For a moment, I honestly don't understand, and then it hits me. They don't have a problem with what I've done, just with who I am.
Author Jodi Picco there, reading from her book Small Great Things, recorded live for Writers on a New England Stage. When we come back, I'll talk with her about getting beyond the hesitation to write this book, confronting implicit bias and creating a character with much more apparent bias, a white supremacist. That's when Writers on a New England Stage with Jodi Picco continues on this special edition of Word of Mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott with a special edition of Word of Mouth. Today, Jodi Picco, recorded live at the Music Hall in Portsmouth for Writers on a New England Stage. Her most recent novel is called Small Great Things. Before the break, Jodi Picco talked about the doubts that kept her, a white woman, from writing in the voice of a black character. Maybe not what you'd expect from the author who's written as a suicidal teen, a school shooter, victims of rape and child sexual abuse, and dozens of others in her best-selling novels. But race is different, she says. It is fraught and hard to discuss, and so as a result, we often don't. Let's get back to my conversation on stage with Jodi Picco and pick up a related question from the audience about how she develops those characters.
Well, that leads to one of the questions from the audience about how character-driven your novels are, but how research-intensive they are. And in order to be ready to write in the voice of an African-American woman, you did a lot of work. So one of those things was interviews with African-American women. What kinds of things did you hear that informed your writing?
So I'll back up a little bit, because before I could even interview women of color, I really had to do a little work myself. I wasn't going to ask my readers to unpack all of their biases if I hadn't done it. So I actually started off by reading a lot of work by racial justice educators and experts so I could get a vocabulary. Then I went to a racial justice workshop. And I went in there thinking, oh, come on, I'm a pretty good person. I'm open-minded. And I left every single night in tears, because there were things that came up in these workshops that I just never had thought of before.
Like what?
For example, there was an Asian American woman who was in tears talking about her love-hate affair with eyeliner, because she couldn't use it easily on her own features, but it was the standard of beauty that she'd been brought up with in America. There was an African American woman who stood up and talked about how every morning she has to put on a mask, a metaphorical mask, and go face people in a way that she becomes the kind of black woman they can handle, that she could never really be authentic. She had to be what people expected her to be. And I thought both of those times, I have never felt that. I never will feel that. And that in itself, that ignorance, is such a privilege. And I hadn't really tapped into those privileges. Then I sat down with women of color, and I did about 100 hours of interview tape with multiple women. And I was asking them all kinds of stuff, their failures, their hopes, their successes, their fears. And again, it was their stories that really spoke to me. There was one young woman who had just had her second son and who talked to me the morning after there was yet another shooting by the police of an unarmed African-American man. And she came in very upset and said, how do I keep my son safe when he grows up? How do I teach him to not be black? And she was the one who asked me, how often do you talk about race with your kids? And I said, you know, when something's in the news. And she said, I talk about it every night, because it's a matter of life and death. And, you know, all of these stories accrued, and they began to make me realize that racism is not just about prejudice. You could take every skinhead and ship them off to Mars, there would still be racism in the U.S. That's because it's also about power and privilege. And if you happen to be born with light skin in this country, you have opportunities and advantages that other people don't have, and sometimes that are a direct result of the fact that they don't have them.
Well, some of the most interesting insights in this book, you gave us a really great portrait of Ruth, you know, a professional, a woman who really cares about a job, but she's also, quote unquote, passing. She's living, working in a white world. She has a relationship with her son, who she tells him every day, you know, you are more than just a black person. But he also hears her when she answers the phone. He's like, were you just talking to a white person? Because your voice changes.
I love Edison. He's one of my favorite characters. Yeah.
He's such a fantastic character. Yeah. But also that kind of idea of, you know, does she believe it?
What's really interesting about Ruth, like many of the women that I spoke with, is that she, all the decisions that she has made in her life have been a result of trying to make sure that her son has a better life. But it's her definition of better. And one of the things that you see on spool in the book is that Edison has grown up in a very well-off white neighborhood in New Haven. He goes to a predominantly white school. He has white friends. He goes on vacation with them. But it isn't until he asks out one of those white friends' sisters that suddenly he's black. And that is something I heard from a lot of the women that I spoke with.
So you say, as you say, you know, race is fraught. It's a different category. You can write as a white supremacist or, you know, a rape victim, but writing as a black woman is a very different thing.
And honestly, it's, you know, I really struggled with that. There's a lot being said now about the right to write and own voices and whether we should kind of write in our own lane or transcend them. And I really, I know that reading this book will be a different experience for a person of color than it will be for a white person, and I'm actually okay with that. I had to think really hard about why I was telling this story, and if I did decide that there was a reason I needed to tell it, and it was because of the audience I was headed toward, then I had to do my homework, and I had to write with compassion and empathy, and with these amazing women who not only shared their stories, but then personally read the manuscript and vetted the voice of Ruth so that she was authentic. That was very important to me. You know, it's, if you're a person of color and you read the book, the best I could hope for is that you would say, okay, she did do her homework, and I appreciate the fact that she's trying to have this conversation. I think if you're a white person and you read the book, you're going to be rattled, and I think that's good.
I was rattled.
Good. Thank you.
You know, I'm one of those people who thinks, like, you know, I grew up in New Hampshire, but I had parents who were liberal. You know, it was a different, if it was a different story for me. I lived in the South for a long time, so I thought, you know, I don't have all those hang-ups that other people have. What was revealed to you about your own inner vision of yourself as a white person?
I mean, honestly, that I'd grown up for 47 years of my life not talking about race, and that is a huge privilege. You know, you can ask my kids. I now that I have started this journey, and it's a journey, and I'm still learning, and I'm still going to make mistakes, but I've learned that just because you don't talk about something doesn't mean it's not your problem, and that it is more important for us to have this conversation, make mistakes, say, I'm so sorry, thank you, I'm learning from that, and let's move forward, than to not talk about it at all.
You're listening to a conversation with Jodi Picoult, recorded live at the Historic Theater at the Music Hall in Portsmouth for Writers on a New England Stage. So, at those workshops, in those conversations with those women, did you feel flat-footed? Did you feel like, oh, I hope I didn't just say something
stupid? I felt like an idiot. I mean, I left in tears every night. I just felt like the most ignorant person ever. It was honestly so eye-opening for me. And I think the really important thing is that we do feel like we're going to make mistakes. We do feel like we're going to say the wrong thing. We're paralyzed by it. We feel guilty. Look, I'm going to wake up white tomorrow. I know that. And I can't change that. So what can I do with that? What can I do with that privilege that makes this world a slightly better place?
Well, you also have the privilege of being a writer whose books are read by millions of people.
That's what I was going to say. And that's, no, this is really important. And that's really the main thing. We need to be talking to people like us. We need to talk to the people who don't want to have conversations about racism. This is super easy. You all can have a homework directive. You're all going to celebrate Thanksgiving, and everyone has a racist uncle who says a really stupid joke at Thanksgiving, right? And what do you usually do? You say, oh, it's Uncle Bob. He's 95. He's never going to change. Well, let this be the year that you say, hey, you know, Uncle Bob, you shouldn't say that. Here's why. if you don't have that conversation, he may never hear the other side. He may never start to change his mind, and he still might not. But at least you've made that introduction. You know, one of the really cool things that you can do with the privilege of being white is recognize that people listen to you. People listen to me. I certainly have a voice. But in most cases, if you're white, people care about your opinion, and you will always be called on at a board meeting, and you will always be at the table when important discussions are happening. And sometimes a really cool thing that you can do with that privilege is to say, are you all listening? Are you listening? Excellent. And you pass the microphone to someone whose voice has not been heard historically. That's a really great thing to do. Look for the person who hasn't been speaking. Look for the person whose point of view is not represented. And very often that can be a person of color who isn't invited to speak up. Make sure that person is heard.
Well, so we live in New Hampshire, a majority white state by mm-hmm. a long shot.
Yep.
There's a question here. What influence has living in New Hampshire had on your writing in general and on Small Great Things in particular?
Yeah, that's a really, really good question. In a way, this is exactly the place that I need to have this discussion. You know, I live in Hanover, and I'm so grateful every day to Dartmouth because at least there's just a smidge of color in my town because there are kids who come to the university from various places. But that is not true in a lot of places in this state. And there's a reason for that. I've actually had so many conversations with my husband about this because we both love this state so much. And he says, I just don't understand. I don't understand. Why aren't more African-American families flocking here? You know, and the reason is really that, honestly, race is bundled up so tightly with socioeconomics that it's very hard to separate the two. And for many African-American families, for example, childcare is something that happens in the confines of a city where you can drop your kids off with their auntie after school and you can go work your second job. And those opportunities don't always exist in New Hampshire, where sometimes, you know, the distance between you and your job is 45 miles. You know, it's a little different. We don't have public transport, at least not up north where I live. And, you know, there are lots of reasons historically that we have not seen an influx of people of color into New Hampshire, which means it's even more important for us in this white space to talk about racism, to ask ourselves why, and to make sure that if we are part of a company, if we're part of a school, we are actively looking for people of color to join us and our community, because let's face it, we're really boring if we only listen to voices like our own. Mm. You know, we really should be trying to expand and hear diverse voices. That's your leading edge. That's how you learn.
Well, as you mentioned, you know, it is easy to pick out a racist. And one of the characters here, Turk Bauer, you know, as you do in your books, you get inside the head of these people. This mm-hmm. is an angry white supremacist, a history of violence against minorities, including his own father, who was mm-hmm. gay. So how do you do that? I mean, where do you turn to learn, like, how a white supremacist thinks?
You do research. So I met with two former white supremacists, one in L.A. and one in Iowa. And these are men who both had very, very violent lives. One of them was living in L.A., running with a very violent skinhead crew in the 80s. And at one point, he beat up a gay man and left him with his head bleeding against a curb, assuming he was going to die. And years later, after he wound up getting out of the movement, one of the first things he did was write a letter to the rabbi of the Simon Wiesenthal Center. Because in his heyday as a skinhead, he had written a very offensive letter to the man and he wanted to apologize. And the rabbi wrote back and said, why don't you come work for me? And so he went to go work for the Wiesenthal Center, basically giving talks every day about leaving a life of hate. One day he looked up in the cafeteria, and there was the man he had left for dead, who was now a docent at the Wiesenthal Center and leading a tour group through. Their eyes connected, and they wound up over a period of months sitting down, talking to each other, apologizing, accepting an apology. They are now friends. They spend holidays at each other's houses, and every day they give talks about their story. The other man that I met with ran with a very violent crew in Philadelphia, And his story was that he went to jail at one point, and he found out that he had more in common with the young African-American inmates than he did with the white ones. And they would talk about the girls they missed and the food they missed. And then when he got out of jail, he went to go work for a Jewish man. And of course, he had been told that this Jewish man was going to absolutely steal him, you know, steal his money and not pay him. Anyway, the day before the contract ended, this Jewish man called in Frankie and said, he was thinking, oh, here it comes, I'm not going to get my pay. And the Jewish man basically said, you've been doing such an exemplary job, I actually want to give you twice what I contracted. And Frankie started to realize, how many exceptions to the rule do there have to be before you have to change the rules? So both of these guys have had dramatic changes and dramatic turnarounds. One of them is now married to a Jewish woman. The other one works with the FBI to ferret out individuals who are white supremacists. What I learned from them was overwhelming and intense. What I will tell you is that everything you read about Turk was something that they experienced, one of them experienced.
Jodi Picco there, talking about creating Turk, a violent skinhead and one of the three primary characters in her new novel, Small Great Things. Our conversation was recorded live at the Music Hall in Portsmouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. When we come back, we'll get Jodi Picco's insights into the American criminal justice system and find out why she burrows so deeply into topics that other people would rather avoid. That's when my conversation with Jodi Picco continues, a special edition of Word of Mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott, and this is a special edition of Word of Mouth. Today, Jodi Picco, recorded live at the Music Hall in Portsmouth for Writers on a New England Stage, a co-production of NHPR and the Music Hall. Picco's new novel is called Small Great Things, and it continues her streak of bestsellers about fraught legal issues that often get battered around in tense courtroom scenes. Scenes like Sister's Keeper, 19 Minutes, and several others. In Small Great Things, a black nurse named Ruth Jefferson has been charged with murdering a white infant left in her care. The child's father is a skinhead named Turk with a history of violence. Ruth is represented by Kennedy McQuarrie, a white, well-intentioned public defender who knows the system and would never consider herself to be a racist. Let's get back to my conversation with Jodi Picco, recorded in front of a live audience at the Music Hall in Portsmouth. So another thing that really comes up in this book, and the legal system has come up in a lot of your books, this is a question from a 13-year-old who became interested in the law because of your books.
Love that.
And I want to know how you find the facts for the trials in the book, something I think we've all been pretty well gripped by.
Honestly, you know, it's part of research. So for this book, you obviously heard me read a lot about a labor and delivery nurse. I had to meet with labor and delivery nurses in order to learn that because I'm not a labor and delivery nurse. Well, I'm also not an attorney. But when I write a book that has something legal in it, I will definitely meet with attorneys and have many arguments with them in the crafting of a fictional trial. What's really interesting about this particular book is I almost came to blows with the attorneys because one of the things that comes up in this book is the fact that in our country, you do not mention race in a trial. Even things that are incredibly racially motivated, for example, the shooting of Trayvon Martin by George Zimmerman, the judge literally prohibited the term racial profiling from being uttered in court.
On what grounds, though?
Florida? I don't know. No, I'm not sure. But the point is that if you want to lose a case, that's when you bring up race. Because race is so polarizing, you don't know what your jury is thinking, you don't know what your judge is thinking, and that becomes a big sticking point for Ruth and Kennedy. Kennedy wants to do her job. She wants to save Ruth. She wants to get her acquitted. And Kennedy knows exactly how to do that, and it is absolutely going to have nothing to do with the fact that a skinhead accused Ruth of something. You know, so on the other hand, Ruth, this for her is a call to justice. And in a way, it almost doesn't matter if she's acquitted. This is like, this is a sticking point for her. And they really become very, they come at loggerheads about whether or not race should be brought up in court. When you read this book, think about the fact that we do not talk about race in any trial, even the ones that we all know are racially motivated.
Yes, I mean, what kind of views do you have on the criminal justice system in America after your research for this book?
Well, I think it's really hard to get a fair trial if you are not a certain type of defendant. I also think that what makes trials particularly dicey when there's an element of racism involved is that even the defendants, the jurors who would tell you, I'm not racist, I may be white, but I'm not racist, there's still implicit bias. And of course, if anyone is as politically addicted as I am right now, you've heard the term implicit bias recently. And here's the thing about implicit bias. Everybody has it. Beverly Daniel Tatum, who is an incredible racial justice educator and the former president of Spelman College, describes implicit bias as the smog of racism in the air. It's everywhere. We don't see it, but we breathe it in every single day. It is the sense that even a person of color will have implicit bias in favor of white people because that's how they grow up in the world. You know, so when you hear, for example, let's just say, you know, a vice presidential candidate saying there can't be implicit bias because it was an African-American cop who shot that boy, there's still a reason that there's implicit bias. Mm. So, I just think that that's really important to think about when we're thinking about the criminal justice system. There are still a lot of ways that it is heavily imbalanced, not to mention the incarceration of African Americans, which happens at a ridiculous skewed rate. There's a terrific book, if you haven't read, you should, called The New Jim Crow by Michelle Alexander, which talks about how incarceration is the new slavery and is a fascinating and really appalling look at our criminal justice system.
You do, in the book, spend a fascinating amount of time for me on jury selection and the importance of jury selection. And as you said, you know, that people who have implicit biases, but they don't really recognize it. But there's also an interesting sort of class race thing going on there.
Yeah.
Because Ruth looks like, you know, she went to an Ivy League school for her nursing degree. She looks like what is said in the book is uppity.
Mm-hmm. Right, and that's, you know, it's very interesting that what would be considered a strong female, if you're white, would be uppity if you happen to be an African-American female. Mm-hmm. You know, and you can dissect that, because you could also argue that strong female is not necessarily a compliment, but strong man is, you know. And I think we all know where I would be going with that.
Let's talk about Kennedy a little bit, who is the court-appointed attorney. And, you know, she has to confront, as you did going through these workshops, her own racism, her own implicit biases, you know, as a woman who is dedicated to working with people charged in the criminal justice system. You know, she's a do-gooder in mm-hmm. the classic sense, right? Mm-hmm. So I was wondering if there's any of you in there, you know, the parts of you that had to confront, as you said, the veneer peeling
100%.
off.
100%. And honestly, there is a part of everyone in this audience in Kennedy. That's kind of the point. She's your vehicle into the book, I think. And she's certainly, she's the one who was my inroad into this story. She's why I needed to tell this story. We are all us white women, we are all Kennedy. And we all like to think that we are blameless, but we're not.
The sense is that advantages and disadvantages are on this kind of scale, right? That,
yeah.
You know, as a white person, I am just instantly have sort of privileges and more opportunities than somebody who's born with different color skin.
It's like headwinds and tailwinds. That's the way I like to think about it. And that's actually, that comes from Debbie Irving's book, a terrific book called Waking Up White. But the idea that it's really easy for us to see headwinds of racism, to know that there are ways that if you are a person of color in America, it might be harder for you to achieve success. But it's really hard for us to notice the tailwinds, to notice that there are benefits to having white skin in this you know, country. We like to pretend it's luck or hard work, you know, and honestly, sometimes it's a direct result of the fact that you have had an opportunity that a person of color has not. It might not be even something you know. You might have an apartment because your landlord didn't want to rent to a person of color, and that might have benefited you unwittingly. But you might also think, okay, I went to a really good school, and it was because I worked really hard, I got good grades in my SATs. Well, that also could be because your mom was home every night to read to you when you were little, and she instilled a value in that in you. And a person of color might have had a mom who had to work three jobs and wasn't around to read to her at night, and was therefore always at a disadvantage and always catching up to where you were. And, you know, when you look at it that way, suddenly the American dream isn't quite so dreamy. And it really, for me, it has been a seismic, prismic shift in the way I see the world.
Well, that's part of my question, is that with these advantages in education, housing, job opportunities, the way you're treated by law enforcement, so how do you begin that conversation, or how do you propose making that change or speaking with somebody about it when what they perceive is loss? I mean, it seems like a zero-sum
game. That's a really
game.
Good point. A lot of people, you know, feel that it's hard for white people to accept this because if you do so, it means you lose something. You lose your winning lottery ticket. Why would I want to upset an apple cart where I'm always the winner, right? That's kind of going on in the background. And it really, it does require that seismic shift and realizing when you level the playing field, it's not that someone wins and someone loses. Everybody wins. Everybody wins when everyone has a fair path to success. Yeah.
Well, it's one thing with Uncle Bob, right? And
right.
But, you know, also I think a lot of us live in almost an echo chamber of people who think somewhat like us, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
One of my neighbors is going door to door getting registering people to vote. And one of our older neighbors is really terrified about immigrants, and she's really upset about people not respecting police. So how do you begin a conversation with somebody like that who has this kind of fear?
That's a really good question. I would hand them Small Great Things. I would read the book. And I would honestly, I'd start talking from the point of view of the book. Let the fiction do your work. Let me take that hard part off you. Honestly, it's like, I hope it's a tool. I really do, because it's really hard to dive into that conversation. Where do you even start? Because she's going to put up a wall the minute you start talking. So don't. Say, read this book. You're going to enjoy this book. I really enjoyed it. Talk about the characters, and then begin to ask her questions based on them. Like I'm saying, the beauty of fiction is that it lets us get into messy discussions about truth and facts that we would rather not have.
You're listening to a conversation with Jodi Picoult, recorded live at the Historic Theater at the Music Hall in Portsmouth for Writers on a New England Stage. Question from the audience here. Any of your books you thought you wouldn't finish?
The one I told you about earlier. You know, I actually tried really, really hard to finish that, and it didn't happen. Excuse me. There have only been two books in my life that I didn't finish. That was one of them. And the other one was a book, I honestly don't even remember what it was about, but I do remember the genesis of it was the fact that Dartmouth students move so slow on campus that I always was afraid I was going to hit them when I'm driving. And it had to do with like a hit and run, and it was like, it was a good book. It was like a mystery, and I shelved it because I kept hearing the voice of a character in my head that was not in this book, who kept saying to me, I was 6 years old the first time I disappeared. And she was so annoying that I finally sat down one day and wrote 40 pages in her voice and realized that was the book I should be writing, and that turned into Vanishing Acts.
Ah. Let's see. Do you have a favorite book out of all that you've written?
So, I mean, I've been asked this question forever, like for 25 years now, and I have always said Second Glance, right? I'm sure there are people here who have heard this. This book has superseded that. Uh-huh. And honestly, I've never had a book grab me by the throat so far, you know, like this one has. It's not just how much I learned. It's that even now, I can't get rid of it. I can't stop talking about it. I am not thinking about my new characters yet. I'm not thinking about anything yet except for the people who inhabit this book and what they've learned. It just really has settled in me.
I guess I'm throwing out all the questions about which book you're working on.
Yes. Yeah.
You never answer that anyway.
I know what I'm doing next, but I'm not telling you, so sorry.
But you have written books about suicide, abused wives, rape victims, you know, victims of physical abuse. I have a friend who's here tonight who devours your books. And one of her friends asked her why she reads such depressing books. So what is the draw for you of difficult subjects and pushing into that thing that people think, oh, I just don't want to hear about it?
I think that's why I write. You know, I mean, to me, the act of writing a book for me is actively struggling with something that's bothering me. And I usually come to a topic because it's keeping me up at night, and I'm worried as a wife, as a woman, as an American, as a mom, you know, I just can't shake this thought. And if I keep thinking about it long enough, like, characters just pop up like little mushrooms, and they begin to create a story for me. And that is the act of writing a book for me. It's the act of working through something I don't understand. I'd like to think it's maybe the same act that reading is for all of you when you pick up the book. But for me, it's not depressing. It's learning. It's trying to wrestle with something that is confusing to me. So I guess it's like therapy in 400 pages or something like that. But that's basically why I write about those things. I also fully believe I could not write about the things that I write about if I were living anything like that.
I know the book has only been out for a couple of days, but I'm wondering what kinds of things you are hearing from readers. Mm-hmm. And reviewers.
It's been an overwhelmingly positive response from readers, which is very gratifying and very humbling. I think it's causing conversations. I've had multiple emails from people in literally the 4 days I've had events saying, you know that conversation you wanted me to have? It happened last night, and here's what I did. And that is so great. That is really all I could ask for this particular book. I'm really pleased and humbled at the same time by that. And it's going to be an interesting ride. I mean, I know there are going to be people who are mad because I chose to write this book. There are going to be people of color who think I don't have the right to write it. There are going to be white people who call me a race traitor. And you know, I kind of feel like I knew this was coming. I decided to walk into the kitchen. It's going to be hot. It's okay. I can take it. I would still rather take it and stand there sweating than not have written this book at all.
I saw a review from Roxane Gay in the New York Times. I mean, she's an author, she's a commentator, she's a Haitian American, and she applauded you for your vigorous research, mm-hmm. your good intentions, and your awareness of your fallibility. Mm-hmm. And having said that, she also said, this is, you know, she acknowledged, as you do, it's for a predominantly white audience.
Yeah, I really was very pleased that she got that, yeah. You know.
So what about for the rest of us, she says then?
Yeah, well, that was a really interesting line for me, because when I read that, I thought, thank you, that's lovely, but I would not and never should be writing a book about racism for people of color.
But she was kind of spurring you on. She said, I hope you do it.
I would argue I should never do that, honestly. And, you know, I would be the first to tell you, here's what I wish for all of you. Read this book, and then if you look at your bookshelf and it's predominantly white authors, that's a really good way to check your own implicit bias. Ask yourself why, and then go out and change that. That's a really easy change to make. You know, it's great when we read the voices that are like us, but we learn more when we read voices that aren't like us. And so, although I think it is fantastic that Roxane Gay might trust me enough to write a book for an audience of color, I would say I prefer to read that story from someone who's lived it. Mm. I can approximate it, I can do my homework, but honestly, it's people of color who can really tell you what it's like to be a person of color in America.
Well, we know the cultural trope of the white savior, right?
Yes.
And you are, you know, here we are again in this majority white state. So what's the role of the white ally? What's a small, great thing that we can do?
I am going to make this so easy for you. I stole this from a really great activist called Kayla Reed on Twitter. But the word ally itself is a great mnemonic for what you should be doing if you want to be a white ally. A, always center the oppressed. So it's not about you, it's about someone else. L, listen to people who are living this life. Talk to the people and understand where they've come from and what they face every day. L, leverage your privilege. Go talk to Uncle Bob at Thanksgiving. And Y, yield the microphone. Make sure that someone else's voice is heard if it's not often heard.
This is the time to summon your Jodi Picoult love and thank her for being here tonight. Thank you. Jodi Picou, the ultra best-selling author. Her newest book is called Small Great Things. Writers on a New England Stage is a co-production of New Hampshire Public Radio and the Music Hall in Portsmouth. The Music Hall executive producer is Patricia Lynch. Music Hall producer, Margaret Talcott. NHPR's president is Betsy Gardella. NHPR's broadcast producer, Logan Shannon. Digital producer, Sarah Plord. The Music Hall production manager is Jana Morris. Live sound and recording engineer for the Music Hall is Jason Martin. Musical director and band, Bob Lord and Dreadnought. Post-production music from Poddington Bear. Live stage photography, David J. Murray of Clear Eye Photo. You can see photos from this event and hear other interviews in the Writers on a New England Stage series, all at wordofmouthradio.org. Just before the show, Jodi Picou recorded a 10-minute writer's workshop, which we are producing as we speak. If you want to know when it gets posted, you can like us, either on Word of Mouth on Facebook or 10-Minute Writer's Workshop, or follow 10MWW Podcast on Twitter. I'm Virginia Prescott, and this has been a special broadcast of Word of Mouth from NHPR.